speaker today is Tom Butler. He is currently the Population Program Director at the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's a conservation activist and writer. Tom helped found the journal Wild Earth in 1991 and served as editor from 1997 to 2005. He is a co-founder and continues to serve as a board member of the Northeast Wilderness Trust, the only regional land trust in the northeastern United States, which is focused exclusively on protecting forever wild landscapes. He works on editorial and ecological projects with the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He has written text for his first book, his first solely authored book, on privately funded natural areas that will be published in 2008. And he's presently doing research for a book on ecological and social consequences of mountaintop removal mining in Appalachia. He also has been kind enough to donate an edited book from Wild Earth as it was published of selected writings from that journal that is part of our raffle today. So if you haven't signed up for the raffle, you should. This is your chance to win a signed copy of this book. And without further ado, let's turn it over to Tom.
Definitely sign up for that raffle. Win that book. You would be the third person to own it that day. Reports from the publisher. So that would be very exciting. Just one second. I'm grateful to be here with you. This is a real pleasure and a fun thing to talk about privately funded natural areas and wildlands claim to be one of my very favorite topics. Now, I've had the great privilege to collaborate with my colleague and friend, Antonio Vizcaino, the Mexican landscape photographer and conservationist, on this forthcoming book project. It's just been a great amount of fun. By all rights, Antonio is the one who should be here with you. He is the one who's well-traveled and eloquent and tall, dark, and handsome, and knows Latin American protected areas. But unfortunately, you've got me, the chubby gringo from Vermont, without a lot of fancy letters after my name, or even any particular great experience in Latin America. So, I do take my duties, however, as a cultural emissary from Vermont seriously, so I bring you warm greetings from Ben and Jerry and Howard Dean. Thanks to the folks at the Transportation Security Mr. Dean, they can't get on a plane anymore with maple syrup, so now I just have to bring greetings informally and not with maple syrup. What can I add to today's conversation? Well, mostly I am going to bring you pretty pictures of protected areas. I was depending upon John Tabor to be Mr. Doom and Gloom today, and so I'm going to be all happiness and light. Hopefully we're going to have enough time for questions, and I'll tell you what I really think about the state of the world at the end of my talk. I'll tell you what I really think about the intrinsic value of nature, ecosystem services, and maybe you can get me to go on a rant on a few other topics if we have a few minutes. Every photo, every image you see in this presentation is of a strictly protected natural area secured either partly or wholly through private funding initiatives. Now, for nearly 150 years now, Americans have been setting aside some parts of the primeval landscape from exploitation. And of course, the initial focus was on great natural spectacles, the monuments of nature, the great sequoias of California and Yosemite, and of course, the geological curiosities there in Yellowstone. And most early protected areas, like Acadia National Park, were established primarily for their scenic beauty and their recreation values. And it's taken a while, of course, for the arguments for land conservation to evolve beyond these utilitarian and experiential values, the values that we get from visiting wild places. But even now, even despite this evolution, and despite the great innovations in conservation science, protected areas, planning that you've heard about today, it is still the case. Even while most conservation biologists would argue primarily for ecological values, biological values, for protected areas or for land conservation, and many NGOs would, that is not what policymakers are hearing. And I can tell you from personal experience it is very, very difficult to get a federal wilderness area, for instance, a bill passed for that contains kind of biologically rich lowlands. You can get lots of rock and ice high elevation, very hard to get more biologically productive lands in strict levels of protection. And while it's become popular to call lands that we exploit for resources working landscapes, a phrase that I find pernicious and detest, working landscapes, I think our parks, our wilderness areas, our wildlife refuges, and our other conservation lands, our other strictly protected natural areas, are the ultimate working landscapes. They're the landscapes out there that are working for wild nature. Now, have they stopped the extinction crisis? No. Do they solve every ecological problem? Of course not. But I'll tell you, if you've been to Virgin Islands National Park, there's a big difference between the island of St. John and the adjacent nearby islands because of the existence of the protected area. And a lot has been accomplished in that 150 years. And a lot of it has been accomplished through the passion and the energy and the money of private individuals. From Joshua Tree National Park in California to West Texas, Guadalupe Mountains National Park, to the prairies of Kansas, Kansas Prairie Research Natural Area, which is a preserve and biological field station that was established through the generosity of Catherine Borgway, to the McCormick Wilderness Area, a federal wilderness area in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, donated by the McCormick family to the American people, to your own backyard, right here in North Carolina, Great Smoky Mountains National Park. These protected areas and literally thousands others across the United States and in other countries have been passed along to us by earlier conservationists who used private resources to save nature. Now, wildlands philanthropists have ranged from John D. Rockefeller Jr., at the time probably the nation's preeminent philanthropist, trying to secure the iconic American landscape, the Jackson Hole Valley there at the base of the Tetons, range from that to the most obscure sort of person in a more prosaic landscape. A small town botanist, a spinster, Southern Baptist botany professor named Mary Wharton, who spent literally her life savings and her life's energy assembling piece by piece by piece over decades a little small natural area outside of Lexington, Kentucky, where the Elkhorn Creek pools and drops down to the Kentucky River. And she left her entire worldly estate to endow this preserved stewardship after she died. And it's not a public natural area. She wanted strictly protected, so it's open only by invitation or occasional public events. Strictly protected for the wildflowers that Mary Wharton loved. So these kinds of examples and a few others that I'm about to start to on south of the border suggest the richness of this tradition, the role that private funding initiatives played in American conservation history. So just to kind of recap these points, I want to stress that wildlands philanthropy is a too little known but very important stream in our conservation history, and that it has been practiced by a broad array of individuals from all socioeconomic classes, and most importantly, that while it is important to celebrate it and to promote private investment in conservation, at no time should we ever allow ourselves to be trapped into the notion that it somehow supplants strong public funding mechanisms for land protection. Let's go south of the border. In northern Sonora, abutting the U.S. border, where the just south of the U.S. border, just east of Agua Prieta and near Douglas, Arizona. This woman and her husband, Valair Austin, and her husband, Josiah Austin, are creating an incredibly beautiful and ecologically rich protected area. They have assembled about 100,000 acres of 7 or 8 played out ranches that have been overgrazed for 300 or 400 years. They have removed the cattle and instituted a very aggressive ecological restoration program. And this is where several major biomes intersect. You have the Chihuahuan and Sonoran deserts, the Great Plains, the Rocky Mountains, Sierra Madre, all coming together at this point in the Sky Islands region. So you have incredible diversity, both from the confluence of biomes and the elevational stacking of along elevational gradients, the natural community stacking. In the Austin's land, there at Svenka Los Ojos, the watershed of springs, ranges from these broad flat valleys in the Animas and San Bernardino Valley, up through the rugged foothills, and on up to the really rugged high country, the Sierra Madre Occidental. And this is an arid country, of course, and water is the lifeblood of it. The Austins are trying to restore a cienega, a marsh that had been destroyed by agriculture and historic overgrazing. And by implementing a range of really aggressive riparian restoration techniques, this place is reviving. And it is amazing to see the wildlife recover. This has been an entirely privately funded initiative. And to meet this woman, Valerie Austin, who was formerly a New York City socialite, out there in the wilderness, bouncing around and doing erosion control and grasslands restoration, all kind of, in this place, implementing a program to protect a tiny freshwater mollusk that's extremely rare, is just truly inspiring. In a place that has been so degraded for so long, they are helping the land recover and come back to health. The seasonally flooded grasslands, the Pampa of Bolivia, is a really interesting landscape. It's really beautiful, of course. It reminds me of something kind of out of a Dr. Seuss book. And it's appropriate to think of it that way because it's a land of giants. You have giant anteaters on land and giant otters in the river. And it's an extraordinarily rich landscape for wildlife. You have maned wolves and marsh deer and incredible bird diversity. And this area, 125,000-acre wilderness, essentially largely an inholding within Noel Kemp Mercado National Park, which is one of the largest protected areas in South America, was protected due to the incredible foresight and good conservation strategy mind of Alan Weeden and the Weeden Foundation. They have gotten all this conservation value, and incidentally, because of the field station, the refuges, the field station right on the banks of the Paragua River, they're able to monitor and deter upriver traffic by potential timber poachers and settlers. And they've gotten all of this value, this extraordinary conservation value, for about $400,000. They bought 125,000 acres of Bolivian wilderness, where every time, my understanding, every time that tropical ecologist Louise Evans has visited, she's discovered new species. And I think it was new species of small mammals each time she visited. So it's a largely unexplored, incredibly rich area. $400,000, a pittance, trifle, amazing. Espiritu Santo Island, Mexico. Who's the timekeeper? How are we doing? Espiritu Santo Island in the Gulf of Cortez. An amazingly beautiful landscape also. The island is it's one of those proverbial uninhabited desert islands. Roughly 23,000 acres sitting there in those crystalline waters of the Gulf of California. And it was saved just a few years ago, in 2003. By a cross-border collaboration of Mexican-American conservations. It was an extremely complicated transaction because the land on the island had been controlled communally by a local ejido. Because of ejido reform, some of the members of the ejido had sort of secured private title to a developable beach on the ironically titled Bonanza Beach, and that is what they tried to do. Was sell it off, and there was the threat of actually a casino development on Espiritu Santo Island. But a US-based tourism operator named Tim Means and many other US-based conservationists working with Mexican conservationists, including the probably the leading Mexican conservation philanthropist, Manuel Arango, bought all of the private properties. And eventually secured full protection as a federally designated flora and fauna protection area. And it's the first example of that kind of cross-border collaboration using private American funds for a federal Mexican protected area. Little anecdote here. Peter Buckley, the guy there on the right, and Doug Tompkins on the left, were former business partners in Esprit, the fashion company. The first time that Peter Buckley went flying in Doug Tompkins' little plane south of Puerto Montt, Chile, he was blown away by the landscape. This is a stunningly beautiful landscape. And every time he'd say, "Oh gosh, that's beautiful," Doug Tompkins would say, "It's for sale. Buy it." And then fly a little farther and say, "Oh, that is really, that's gorgeous." Doug Tompkins would say, "You know, that's for sale. You could buy that." They'd fly a little farther, and they flew a little farther down to near the volcano Corcovado, where the TikTok River comes down, flows into the bay of Corcovado, and he'd say, "Oh, this is really beautiful. I'd buy that." Doug Tompkins said, "Well, it's for sale. I'll look into it." And they did buy it, roughly 220,000 acres, including about 29 miles of coastline, some of the most pristine coastal rainforest left in Chile, and this incredible volcano lording over it all. That private land, however, was surrounded by federal land, and Doug Tompkins got it into his mind that he would propose a new national park. And he initially had to go to the chief military general in charge of the federal military lands. And he proposed this idea. He said, "Well, you know, what if we were to give this 220,000 acres, when you guys kick in, that is the military, this other 440,000 acres surrounding it, we'll make a new national park." And the general thought, you know, about that. He said, "Well, maybe we could do that, but could we still let our Navy ships that are parked down in the bay fire their heavy guns up the volcano and use the snowfields for practice?" And Doug Tompkins says, "Well, you know, this is really, we had in mind a nature preserve that probably wouldn't be appropriate." And the general thought about that for a moment and smiled and said, "I see your point." I conceded that. And the whole idea actually fell apart because Doug Tompkins became a very controversial figure in Chile for several years. But when President Lagos came into power, the idea was revived. And they told, as you know, something John mentioned earlier, presidents like to create parks. They let President Lagos know that every Chilean president in 1926 had created at least one national park, and he didn't have one. He only had a few years left in his term, and here's one we're handing to you on a plate. Well, the Minister of Defense at that time was a very progressive figure, went along with the idea, and the military did kick in the roughly 40,000 acres, and they created a new, pretty much Yosemite-sized, extraordinarily beautiful national park, Corcovado, centered on the volcano there, that was designated in January of 2005. Roughly 650,000 acres, new protected area. All instigated by private initiative and funding, largely Doug Tompkins and Peter Buckley. Oh, it was, incidentally, the largest gift ever to the Chilean people. It's the largest single act of philanthropy, the value of the land that Doug and Peter gave. I'm going to go real fast through Guanacaste because I suspect many of you folks know about the Guanacaste Conservation Area, and perhaps, Carlos, are you going to be talking about? Oh, well, then I'll just give the highlights. Daniel Jansen, tropical ecologist, has spent decades being the leading visionary behind the area de conservación Guanacaste in northwestern Costa Rica. When he first began doing field work in the area in the early 70s, there was one little national park, Santa Rosa. By 2005, you had two other national parks, a forest reserve, two national wildlife refuges, and some 40,000 other acres of private land bought for conservation. I think the total acreage is up to something like 285,000 terrestrial acres in protection and 173,000 acres of marine reserve. It is the shining example of a dry tropical forest restoration on Earth. And it's also a really innovative thing in the way that the conservation area has integrated the local school children's biological curriculum with the protected area. So over a generation of time, you're creating in this area of rural Costa Rica the most ecologically literate population on earth. It is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. And a lot of that goes to Dan Jansen's vision and also to his spouse, Winnie Hollock's, also the tropical ecologist. Dan Jansen raised tens of millions of dollars for this effort, and though he's not prone to talk too much about it, he and Winnie have donated several million dollars themselves. Every time he won a major prize, like the Kyoto Prize and others, they came with a large cash gift. They recycled that money into the conservation area. In 2004, a huge new protected area in Tierra del Fuego called Caraquinca was established. Caraquinca from the Selknam Indian word meaning our land. Extra credit, who can name that individual, the man on the left? Can anybody tell me who that is? Ah, you're a bunch of conservationists. Nobody reads the Wall Street Journal in here.
Those witnesses.
What? That's Henry Paulson Jr., the former Goldman Sachs CEO and the current United States Secretary of the Treasury. He was at the time when Goldman Sachs came to own this property, some 680,000 acres. Actually, it was more originally, but it's more than closer to 800,000 acres. They came to own a bundle, Goldman Sachs came to own a bundle of distressed debt that was secured by this land that had been held by the former Trillium Logging Corporation based in Washington State. And they had intended to log that. It was the largest remaining example of subantarctic lingua forest left on Earth. It was an extremely contentious, controversial issue, but that logging project in Chile, and Chilean conservationists fought it for years. They litigated it up to the Supreme Court. Conservationists eventually won. Trillium went bankrupt. They defaulted. Goldman Sachs got the note that secured bought the distressed debt bundle fire sale price. And Goldman Sachs, then under the leadership of Henry Paulson, decided to donate that land, 680,000 acres, to the Wildlife Conservation Society. They also donated a huge stewardship endowment to establish a protected area and reserve of biological fuel station. Largest example of corporate philanthropy for protected areas that I'm aware of anywhere in the world. But there was also a significant private investment too. Hank and Wendy Paulson, who you guys saw the photo of, and another Goldman Sachs executive, Larry Linden, both each gave $500,000 to the effort themselves. Los Amigos Conservation Concession in Peru. This conservation concession was the brainchild of ecologists Adrian Forsyth and Enrique Ortiz, the Peruvian conservationist. They negotiated over a number of years with the government of Peru to establish parallel conservation concession protocol parallel to a timber concession, but for biodiversity conservation. And this effort was bankrolled by the Moore Foundation, Gordon Moore, the founder of Intel. It now secures roughly 400,000 acres around the Los Amigos River. And it helps also establish, 5 minutes, wrapping up, helps secure the southern flank of Nanmi National Park. So it has an extraordinary conservation value in and of itself, the area protected, but also the mechanism that it is beginning to pioneer. Okay, wrapping up, we'll zip through these. A couple more. Mount Leon National Park in Argentina is the first coastal Patagonian park protected in Argentina, established in 2002, and it came about because of the woman who formerly ran Patagonia, the clothing company, recycling her personal wealth from that into Patagonia, the place. She, through her NGO, Conservación Patagónica, helped the Argentine Park Service purchase a former sheep estancia, a large private ranch of about 175,000 acres, that the Park Service had long wanted to purchase but had never gotten the deal done. She provided the money, for the purchase of the land and for the development of a management plan that strictly protects the ecological values of the site, including the some 29 miles of Atlantic coastline and its huge colonies of penguins and other shorebirds, and is going to allow this formerly overgrazed land to recover its values over time. Last example, another Doug Tompkins and Chris Tompkins effort, Pooling Park, probably the one most familiar to you folks, at roughly 750,000 acres, a Yosemite-sized protected area along the southern Chilean coast south of Puerto Montt. This effort took Doug Tompkins more than a decade and was extremely controversial. Doug and Chris Tompkins suffered tremendous amounts of vicious rumor and innuendo and negative pressure and death threats and all kinds of nastiness. But Doug Tompkins is a former mountaineer, a guy with first ascents on four continents, and he is not easily dissuaded. He's very bullheaded. He usually makes the summit, and with Pooling Park they did. Eventually, a more friendly presidential administration came in. And Doug Tompkins, taking the heat over the course of a decade in the Chilean media, stimulated a conversation around conservation issues that had never occurred in the popular media in Chile before. In that way, it is extremely valuable beyond the fact of the actual land protection deal. So why do people do this? Of course, the motivations vary, but with Tompkins in particular, it was to secure wild nature from the onslaught of this techno-industrial civilization that is everywhere eating up nature, making a degraded and less beautiful planet. So just to conclude, Wildlands Philanthropy, private funding initiative to establish protected areas, is not universally applicable. But we've seen just in these few examples that from the Alaskan range out at Isambeck National Wildlife Refuge all the way down south to Tierra del Fuego, Wildlands Philanthropy does have an extremely important role to play in establishing protected areas. It's really limited only by the imaginations of people who will do this work, who will choose to leave their legacy on the land. And they want to ensure that their energy and their resources go to securing a place that where wilderness and wildlife can flourish for all time. And there we are in the Great Smokies, and I'll conclude with that image. Do we have any time for questions? Okay, full disclosure for the first question. I work for Doug Tompkins. I am not his publicist. I work for the Foundation for Deep Ecology, but I was a longtime admirer of his work in South America and his grant-making in North America before I worked for him. My thoughts here are only my own. They're not part of any company line.
Toss out two questions. One, would you care to comment on private money purchasing and then putting a park into public ownership versus private ownership and management of reserves in terms of what works, what doesn't? Does it depend?
Yes, it depends.
Okay. And the other, I'm just curious, you zipped through it so fast. What was exactly were you commenting on versus about working landscape? And tied to that is, I guess, what is your definition of strict protection? Because different people sometimes mean slightly stricter things than others.
First question first, it depends. In certain contexts, the very best thing you could do for a big wild place is to protect it strictly as a private reserve without public access. Certainly that is the case. But what that doesn't do is serve the broader goal of developing a public constituency for nature. And Doug Tompkins has been very, very strategic about this point. By creating new national parks, he's helped developing a national parks ethic and a public constituency for protected areas in Chile. Most of those parks are way off limits to people. You can't get to them. The vast majority of these protected areas are inaccessible to people. And so the degrading factors of public access don't necessarily apply. Public access is a worthwhile thing and still achieve strict biological conservation. As far as what do I mean by strictly protecting areas? When I was looking for places to profile in our Wildlands Swinthrop book, my criteria was scenic beauty, strict protection for nature, that is, areas not with resource extraction. No logging, no grazing. Now, in U.S. national parks, of course, we have some recreational development. But I was looking for, generally speaking, areas that are managed for nature.
I just want to interject.
Oh, I didn't. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't go to working landscape, so I'll pick that back up.
Sure. To acknowledge to this group that Doug Tompkins started Parks Watch. You gave us the very first grant.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Good for him. Why do I detest the term working landscape? Because it has a fundamentally utilitarian bent. Working landscapes, as used typically by industry and by far too many conservationists, are lands that we exploit, that we log, that we graze, that we extract resources for human use. And in too many cases, they are worked over landscapes. To my mind, that is a pernicious term with a fundamentally utilitarian anthropocentric bent.
You mentioned that techno-industrial society is destroying the last natural areas left on the planet. Is that your comment?
I think I said techno-industrial civilization is gobbling up nature, something like that. I don't know exactly what I said.
What I've learned, it's those people marginalized by this society that are destroying these areas. And that is not their fault, but because they're disempowered by that society. And that's it's these people who are burning down forests, as in Dr. Turbo's talk, to build ranches to make food. So
human population pressures, as John said over and over, are a driver of degradation of protected areas. But the economic order, that is, economic globalization based on a kind of the most rapacious form of capitalism, is destroying the planet. And I cannot imagine a thoughtful conservation biologist or any even graduate student that has a passing knowledge of the technical literature in conservation biology over the last 20 years that would disagree if you got them out in the woods around a campfire or had a couple of wee drams of single malt scotch. They would say, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, the world is burning. Ecosystems are unraveling. And protected areas are a stopgap measure. They're absolutely crucial. We need more of them. We need bigger, wilder, interconnected protected lands. But in and of themselves, they will not stop the destruction of wild nature. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just the crowd that I hang out with. But most people, and this goes to the fundamental tension in social change movements between incrementalists, people who are content to reform and tinker around the edges of a system, and people like Doug Tompkins, who want a sustained, substantial critique of root causes. And let's face it, you guys are being trained to be really smart resource managers and mitigate the worst effects of a culture and an economic order that's fundamentally toxic to nature. But if you are honest and you go out into the job market and you start talking like I am right now, you're marginalized. You are nowhere. You're not getting tenure, and you're not getting a cushy job at TNC or WWF. You're not going to do it if you start critiquing the dominant economic order. And so people don't do it. Only that marginalized fringe on the grassroots end of the conservation community does it. And over and over, I've seen those people called flakes and marginalized and thrown under the bus.
I was going to say, before we point fingers at marginalized people, go on like WCS's website and do your footprint analysis.
It's us. That's a good segue to my question. Not a question. I mean, we talk about these incredibly filthy rich people doing these conservation measures, but I mean, how did they make their money? A lot of them made their money
through the destruction of nature, through being part of that economic system.
How does that make any sense to me?
Well, let me ask you: if you're Gordon Moore and you're a billionaire, how many houses and yachts and jet planes are you going to buy? Should you, as the beneficiary of this destructive economic order, buy more yachts or try to save some nature?
That's not my question. I mean, what I'm saying.
Well, that's my question.
Buy some nature parks. I think that's a great idea if I'm that rich. But what I'm saying is, it doesn't seem sustainable, this idea of private funding for this. Because the only way you can make that much money is by doing the opposite of what you're doing by buying a park.
Well, two questions. First of all, yes, I can see part of your point. It's not sustainable for the long term because this whole system is unsustainable. It's all going to crash. It's going to unravel sooner or later. Anybody in this room knows that. Any thoughtful person recognizes that. We do our best to ignore it, but that collapse is coming. The unraveling of the economic and political and social order that we have known, that we've come to depend on, is not going to persist very much longer. Now, if you say that, you're marginalized as a catastrophist or an apocalyptic sort. And of course, a lot of people say, we don't matter because the rapture's coming, you know? What the heck? Let it burn. A party on. As I got at the airport to fly from here yesterday, I saw a guy with a huge Hummer. The license plate said, "Living for me." Thank God he was not a Vermonter. Everybody in Vermont drives a Prius. This guy had New York plates. But Mr. Hummer, Mr. Hummer with the "Living for me" mantra is the problem. No, it's not sustainable.
He's the guy behind the parks.
It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. But as long as people are making money, channeling private wealth back into public values in the context of a protected area with a goal of saving biodiversity is the very best use of personal wealth, in my view. And finally, I mostly showed you big fancy examples. Dan Jansen is not a rich guy. He's a tropical ecologist who wears really ratty clothes. He's given all his money. He's raised money. I didn't show you the pictures. One of the protected areas in our book was saved by people like you. It was two grad students at the University of Colorado who got sick and tired of going out to these prairie dog hunts and wrapping kryptonite bike locks around their neck and trying to keep the thugs from, you know, shooting the prairie dogs and getting hauled off to the jail. And they're like, "What can we do? This is getting dull. I don't like sitting in this jail." He said, "Let's start a land trust." They use their student loans to make the payments, the debt payment on the piece of property that they protected on the short grass prairie of eastern Colorado. And they got a big new, you know, a 1,200-acre nature preserve for the prairie dogs and the other wildlife. And they had no money. So this can be done by anybody. You give your $25 to the Nature Conservancy, you're a wildland philanthropist. Somebody else had a question up here.
Yeah, I was just wondering if this sort of paradigm where someone buys a piece of land, says it's going to be reserved, and then gives it to the government, is that in any way fundamentally different from a government just creating a paper park? Because in the end, the question is, who's paying for the ongoing protection and maintenance of this area? And in a lot of countries, you could give them a piece of land, but it's going to be invaded.
That's why you don't just give the park, you don't just give the titles, the deeds, you develop an infrastructure and an organizational capacity to protect the area, and you create a stewardship endowment. So there are resources to secure that protected area across all time. This is what other people, what Doug Tompkins has done. There's also a reversion clause with Monteleone. If the Argentine Park Service decides they don't want a national park there anymore, they want to sell that land. Reversion clause, it comes back to Conservation Patagonica. Or actually, it comes back, I think, to the NGO, the Argentine NGO that was the intermediary. So the way to solve that problem is to secure those resources up front as part of the original planning, that, as Nick mentioned. There was another part of that,
sort of going a little bit backwards, thinking about small people going and starting a park. I have relatives in eastern North Carolina who all live next to each other. Between them have about 1,000 acres, not developed. So what do you think of ecosystem services? And how would I convince them to decide to preserve their land? Because they'll, a few years, they want some extra cash, they'll just plow it under whatever.
Well, you're linking one argument for land conservation, ecosystem services, to a desire to help them understand the value of protecting their property.
Yeah.
In my mind, that's not a particularly useful tool. With most landowners, if you're trying to secure, a protected area with a local or regional land trust, there's a range of tax benefits and other values that are more likely to resonate with an individual landowner than something as esoteric as ecosystem services. You know, most people on my block have no idea what nutrient cycling is. But if you say, you know, that really cool place where the coyotes crossed the stream and where we saw those red foxes and the fishers a year ago, let's make sure that doesn't get a house on it. What can we do as a community? Why don't we donate a forever wild easement to our local land trust and make sure our taxes will go down and we'll make sure that that's protected forever. Now, as far as ecosystem services, I think our keynote speaker is going to, where's Carlos? Is going to address this, and I don't mean to be disrespectful in any way. I haven't heard your presentation yet, but I'm going to say I just can't help it. I hate this idea of valuing nature. It's awful. It's awful. I fully concede that it is a useful tool when you're working within the context of a corrupt, fundamentally toxic system. When discussing with that oil and gas person across the way, it may be a useful conservation tool. But at the root of it, it's awful. It's terrible. That grizzly bear has a right to exist regardless of its utility to me. I can't put a value on it. It's fun when I visit Moosehead Lake to hear the loon singing in the distance, to see her raising her chicks. But her life is her own. It has value in and of itself, whether I'm there to hear it, whether it sells a calendar for a local NGO. Wild places and wild creatures have a right to exist of their own sake. They have intrinsic value. And this is my beef with most NGOs. We are constantly arguing utilitarian arguments for land protection, utilitarian values, anthropocentric values, instead of the most fundamentally ethical argument, which is intrinsic value. We save wild places because they deserve a right to exist, not because it helps us breathe or have clean water or have a neat wildlife watching experience. Those are all great secondary values, but they're secondary. They're not primary. That's my beef with ecosystem services. That's my rant.
I'm going to know a little bit about Doug Humphrey, and I'm generally impressed with the kind of thing he does. The critiques that I've heard that resonate with me is that, we've just seen a series of very beautiful photos of supposedly, pristine landscape. In many cases, there is a human footprint there. It's just not visible. And I think it's very, especially in tropical states, tropical Latin America is kind of where I'm coming from in my experience, but where you have protected areas and you really have to balance. If you buy a piece of land and preserve it forever, it may not necessarily be the best thing for a local population. It may be the best thing for all of Nicaragua or for all of Honduras, but maybe not the village next door. Now, what was I getting to? How does the Hopkins, how does he balance that out? The importance of integrating that local community and its importance and its right to exist, because they're often trapped in poverty and they don't have the kind of options that other people have.
Okay. Well, if we think about the kind of the conventional model of protected areas design, core area, buffer, and corridors, Doug Tompkins is doing all three. And with a very, very strong ecological restoration component. John, you may correct me if I'm wrong, but I think after the salmon industry, I think Doug Tompkins is the largest employer in that region of Chile. Do you know?
I think that's probably.
If he's not the second, he's right up there. Conservation and all the peripheral projects is a huge economic engine in that was region 13 of Chile. Now, I just showed you protected areas because that's what I've focused on. But beyond the parks and the infrastructure that goes along with the parks, there's also a whole bunch of agro enterprises, all kinds of farms pioneering interesting ecological agricultural techniques that can then be exported to local people, and all kinds of interesting efforts to show a more benign way of inhabiting that landscape. Lots of money has gone into that. Lots of really creative and innovative work being done on that. And just one final example. When I visited Pumalin last year, Doug flew me to a little farm. It was outside the park. He lives on a farm out just outside the park, where there are gardens and sheep production and these agricultural enterprises. We flew to another one where a really great young forest ecologist, I forget her name, but a Chilean biologist, has a nursery going. And I saw thousands and thousands of 6-inch tall and 8-inch tall alerce trees. People know what alerces are? Basically the South American equivalent of a coast redwood that were almost completely logged out. The one good thing Pinochet did was he made it illegal to cut alerce trees during the dictatorship. It became, the tree became a national monument and it was illegal to cut them. So there are very few old growth alerce trees. Doug Tompkins has had people in the watersheds finding the examples and collecting seed, and has nurseries and a very sophisticated, they're not just going to put any old alerce, the actual seedlings that came from that genome of that watershed, watershed by watershed. It's called alerce 3000, to have alerce trees back in the forest in 1,000 years. And it's amazing. It's very costly, and it's really exciting. So it's not just wilderness. He's got the people thing and the economic development thing and the restoration thing going on, too. I do sound like his publicist. It's really not my role. But
yeah, I too, would not like to put the price on a grizzly bear, but if we're living in a system that is toxic to nature, what should we do? Because if we're already living in it, what other options do we have unless we're fighting this system or dethroning it?
Use all the tools you can. Again, there's this fundamental tension between incremental changes, people who have to work within the system and do their best, get the best you can, and people who are outside the system and articulating that more fundamental, radical critique of it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing for anybody to use ecosystem services arguments. I'm saying it really bugs me. And if they don't go beyond that, if they stop there, and the worldview stops that, well, the Earth is a really neat place, it's got some great critters, but it's really pretty much just a big smorgasbord for people. That is the problem that is driving the calamity. That is the idea. The fact that we are apart and separate from nature and sovereign over it, that is the fundamental problem that's driving the global extinction crisis. So if you don't ever bring that up, and you stop with mitigation and tinkering around the edges, then I think we've ultimately failed as conservationists because we haven't had the full spectrum of debate.
But while we articulate, we must operate within the system in order
That's
to
correct.
Change things.
Can I take this pause to thank Tom for letting fire?